Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Hello, welcome everyone. This is Bishop Michael Sheridan, Bishop of Colorado Springs. And on today's program, I'm very pleased to have with me my wonderful and holy predecessor, Bishop Richard Hanifin. Bishop Hanifin is well known by most Catholics and many, many who are not Catholic in this area and throughout the state of Colorado. But Bishop Hanifin has been retired for, I think, nearly 8 years now. So many of our new arrivals here in the Colorado Springs area, Pueblo area, may not know him all that well. So this is an opportunity for all of us to get reacquainted again with Bishop Richard Hanifin. Welcome, Bishop.
Thank you, Bishop Sheridan. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Bishop Hanifin is a native of Denver and was ordained to the priesthood for the Archdiocese of Denver. But I'm going to let him sort of tell his story. Why don't you, Bishop, just talk about, I'm sure our listeners would like to hear how you came to hear the call of God in your life and something about the early days of your priesthood in the Archdiocese of Denver.
I thank you, Bishop Sheridan. It's great to be with my holy successor.
Thank you.
I suspect that my vocation is similar to most of the vocations that we have as priests. I came from a family that was really Catholic. Catholic school education, and my parents, I don't think, ever missed Mass on Sunday. I can't recall it ever happening. And it was never a question in our minds as kids whether you went to Mass on Sunday or not. That was a given. And we never resented that, not even as teenagers. It was just a part of our life. So every vocation somehow starts, I think, with that kind of family background.
That sounds very much like my early life, too. Exactly. I don't ever remember missing Mass on Sunday. Yeah. My parents, my whole family, completely devoted to the church, and we participated in the life of the church happily. So, thank you.
It was our life, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So priesthood was no stranger in my house, and my dad was a graduate of Regis, now university, but college in those days, and was close to the Jesuit community as well, so we had regular bridge guests at our house. The Jesuits that liked to play bridge would come to the house and play bridge with my folks. And Monsignor Higgins at St. Philomena's in Denver was very close to our family. He brought my mom into the church. She was a convert from the Episcopal faith. And so I got started that way, but then my Jesuit education after elementary Catholic education, I went to Regis High School, and after that Regis College. And part of the Jesuit tradition was always with their education came the spiritual formation, and particularly the retreat process. That's a big thing in Ignatian spirituality, and they always trained the kids to learn to be silent and to be alone. And so I was on a junior in college retreat between semesters and was being silent and alone. And in the middle of the night, out for a little walk, just before bed, it just hit me like a ton of bricks that I should be a priest.
You had not thought much about it before that?
No, as a matter of fact, I was a very happy dater. I had a great time with girls and felt extremely normal about that. And it really kind of obviously had been in the back of my mind, but not conscious. Now, the reason I say that is when it occurred to me, really out of the dark, you could say, that I should be a priest and that I also could, because I think every kid wonders, can I, even if I want to? And I just heard, you can. And I went into a state of almost euphoria. It was like a huge, some kind of burden that I didn't even know I was carrying had been lifted. I was so happy. And decided then and there that that's what I was going to do. I was going to go to the seminary. But this is interesting to me. Within 2 months, I got a call from a girl that I thought was the hottest thing in town. And I didn't know her. And she asked me to go to the Loretta Heights senior prom with her. And I asked her if she'd go to the Regis prom. And so we dated for almost eight months of the coming year. And of course, those wonderful thoughts that occurred to me on retreat sort of went into the background for a little while we dated. But it was most interesting that we really weren't who we thought we were for each other. And we broke up cordially. And I went into the seminary and never looked back. And that was an important experience for me, that you could almost say the best possible scenario for me had happened, and it wasn't the answer. So it was never a question after that whether I wanted to be celibate or could be.
Given all your years with the Jesuits, how did they miss getting you?
I mean, oh yeah, you know.
Why did you choose the diocesan?
Yeah, exactly. That's what they asked too.
Well, it's a question. You know, we're alike in many ways. I too was sort of raised in those years by the Jesuits, and that's what people ask me. Why are you a diocesan priest if the Jesuits were such a big influence in your life? What was your?
Well, I remember Father Joe Ryan. I took accounting, and it was in my senior year. He had to review our future with us. And he was kind of my mentor, and he said to me, why don't you want to be a Jesuit? And I said, well, because I really don't want to teach. I want to be in a parish. And he said, well, that's exactly right. He said, that's what you should do. Remember, Jesus Christ didn't found the Jesuits. He founded the diocesan priesthood. And I thought, hey, that was pretty cool. So, but that was really it. I wanted to be a parish priest because I knew what the Jesuits did, and I knew what education looked like. I wanted to be with the people on the parish scene, although it turns out that one of my favorite things to do is teach. I think most priests like that.
I'm sitting here smiling because I can't believe how this coincides with my own story. That's exactly the answer, at least I gave to myself and I gave to the Jesuits who asked me. I said, I admire you. I love what you do. I really don't think I want to spend my priesthood as a classroom teacher. I did for 12 years, and I loved it, but I eventually went back to parish work, which was my first love. Let me share this story with you. It's when you were talking about dating this girl, I thought if you come up with the same ending as my story, this will be incredible. I too was dating a girl in high school and into my freshman year of college. And when I had decided at the end of my first year of college that I was going to enter the seminary, I thought, well, I better say something. And so I met her and told her I had something rather important to say, and that I truly believed I was going, you know, wanted to be a priest, and God was calling me to the priesthood, and that I would be entering the seminary in the fall. Now, this sounds like something I made up, but it's the truth. She looked at me and she said, really, I'm entering the convent in the fall. And to this day, she belongs to the Visitation Sisters. She entered in St. Louis, but was part of a group that was sent to the Minneapolis area to establish a new house. So how about that?
How about that?
Our sort of mutual heartbreaking, but we both went on to the vocation that we had received. This is very interesting. So now you were ordained in what year? Ordained to the priesthood in what year?
I was ordained in 1959. I had attended St. Thomas Seminary in Denver. That's now St. John Vianney reestablished. And my first assignment was to the town of Estes Park, where just for the summer I was assigned to be assistant pastor there. And so I went up there for about 8 weeks. And after that was assigned to the cathedral in Denver as with a co-classmate from the seminary. So two of us went there at the same time, two new assistants at the cathedral, and was there for 6 years. The first year I was there, the Archbishop asked five of us from the Denver Archdiocese who were in schoolwork to go to Catholic University and take workshops on counseling and guidance, because the public schools were beginning to require that, and he wanted us to be on a par with the public schools. And so he wanted only priests to be involved in whatever was counseling and guidance. I don't think he understood what that was about, but we went to Catholic U, and several of us went on, and in fact did get our master's degree in counseling and guidance from Catholic U. And I got that in 66 and was on the boat to Rome to study canon law when the degree was granted from Catholic U, and spent 2 years in Rome at the University of the Lateran and the North American College studying canon law, more or less. Because it was in total upheaval in those days. The new code was on the way, and the old code was being discussed, and the council had an impact in Rome. But among the educators at the Lateran, it was still a reactionary kind of education then, because they didn't know where the future was going to take them in terms of canon law. So they were trying to deal with the present ambiguity, which was very difficult, I think, for a lot of our professors. It's tough to teach certitude out of ambiguity. And so I say we learned canon law more or less. But I got that JCL license.
The license, yeah.
Yeah. I always called it Jester at the Court of the Lateran, but got the degree and came home and worked in the chancery from 68 until 74 when I was named an auxiliary bishop. So that was kind of the way things were. I lived at St. Catherine's and ministered in the parish, but also worked as Archbishop Casey's secretary and then chancellor. And through some really hard days when so many of the priests were leaving, I saw that man suffer like so many of the bishops did from just the departure of so many priests. It was a very difficult time.
You were assigned from Denver to the Colorado Springs area, to St. Mary's here, correct? Before we were established as a diocese, right?
Yeah, in 74 I became an auxiliary, and then the following year, the Archbishop said, I want you to go to Colorado Springs and be the vicar for the southern area of the Archdiocese. I want you to pull the parishes in Colorado Springs together. There was a kind of a disjointed operation down here. And I'll talk a little bit later maybe about some of the things that were going on in Colorado Springs at that time. He had some concerns about. But one of the things he was concerned about was the attitude of the people, the Catholics in Colorado Springs, because they did not like Denver. They did not like their archdiocese very well. They suffered from what I called the second city syndrome. They take our money and give us no service in return. Governor Love, one time, the governor of Colorado at that time, shared with Archbishop Casey that was exactly the same thing for him as governor. Denver takes our money and gives us nothing back. So the Archbishop thought it was time for me to come down and try and pull this together a little bit.
Were you fairly successful?
You know, success is a relative term.
I know.
In whose mind was I successful? I can talk about some of the things that worked.
Yeah, but I'm sure your presence must have at least been an expression of the concern of the Archbishop for people even on the south end of the Archdiocese.
It was. That's what he wanted. Yeah.
But you were here, nine years before the... Am I right? Have I got my dates right?
I came 85, in 76.
Oh, 76, sorry.
And in 84.
So it was 8 years. Uh-huh. You were here 8 years before...
Yeah.
The Diocese of Colorado Springs was actually established, so you saw right through the transition.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue this conversation with Bishop Hanifin and find out about his early days here in the diocese and the establishment of the diocese under his leadership. We'll be back in a moment.
Saturday evening, September 18th at the Pikes Peak Center in Colorado Springs, join renowned author and speaker Christopher West for Fill These Hearts, God, Sex, and the Universal Longing. It will be an evening of beauty and reflection on Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body, a bold, organic, and contemporary understanding of human love in the divine plan. Through philosophical reflection, humor, and everyday experiences, Christopher West will unpack the message of the Theology of the Body in a language and application that anyone can appreciate, whatever one's backgrounds or beliefs. In a journey through art, music by indie folk artist Mike Mangione and the Union, live performance and spoken presentations, come to know that meaning behind the Catholic teaching of human sexuality and how it illuminates life's deepest questions. For more information about Christopher West in Colorado Springs and to register, visit www.fillthesehearts.org. That's www.fillthesehearts.org.
We're back. This is Bishop Sheridan with Bishop Richard Hanifin, who was my predecessor and as Bishop of Colorado Springs and actually the founding Bishop of the Diocese of Colorado Springs. Bishop Hanifin, it was in 1974 that you were named a bishop, auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Denver. How did you come to learn of your appointment?
Oh, you know, yes. I didn't know much. I didn't know how bishops got made. I didn't have a clue. But a friend of mine who had left the priesthood and married called me one day out of the blue and said, let's go to lunch. And so he and I went to lunch, and he said to me, you're going to be a bishop. And I said, you're crazy. And he said, you just wait and see. And then we talked about all kinds of other things. We caught each other's lives up and so forth at that lunch. Well, I went home wondering, what's going on here? Why would that happen? And then one of the people with whom I taught at Cathedral High School told me that she heard I was going to be a bishop. So stuff was floating. That scared me a little bit. But I had to pray over that. That's always a scary thing when you get something like that, a little bit unsettling. However, a great deal of time went by, and I began to settle in and enjoy my work with Archbishop Casey, whom I had great affection for him. And so I just went on with life. One Friday afternoon, about 4:30, he said, Dick, come into my office. I just need to talk to you for a minute. And I said, okay. I went in. And he said, do you know anything about Abercorn? And I said, you mean Habercorn? That's my barber, Doc Habercorn. He said, I'm not talking about your barber. I'm talking about Abercorn, Scotland. I said, no, I don't know anything about Abercorn, Scotland. He said, well, you're going to be the Bishop of Abercorn.
That was your titular diocese.
That was my titular diocese as an auxiliary. And the bottom dropped out of my life. I said, well, I don't understand what you're saying. And he said, well, Pope wants to name you my auxiliary, and Abercorn's going to be your titular diocese, and the Holy Father wants to know your answer. And I said, how soon? And he said, well, certainly it's Friday, as soon as you can. I said, well, how about Monday? And he said, well, let me know by Monday, because I have to let him know, or you have to let him know. So I went home, and I was praying over it and had dinner with a couple whose friendship I treasured, and sort of talked to them about it a little bit. And I got a call from him at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, and he said, so what's your answer? The Holy See wants to know. And I said,
he wasn't going to give you till Monday.
Well, they weren't giving him till Monday. And so I said, well, of course my answer is yes. You don't say no. And so he gave me the telegram, the wording of a telegram I was to send, saying I accepted it, and I did, and I've never looked back on that either. That's been being a bishop has been a joy.
Happily, I was spared that anxiety. The only person who ever told me I was going to be a bishop was my mother, and mothers are supposed to tell their priest sons that they're going to be. I think she said I was going to be the Pope someday. So so it really caught me off guard. 6:30 on a Sunday morning. How about that? 6:30 on a Sunday morning, the Archbishop of St. Louis summons me to his residence. I didn't know what in the world. I said, Archbishop, do you realize it's Sunday? I thought maybe he thought it was Monday. No, it was, you'll be back in time for Mass, don't worry. And I went down there, and that's when he told me, and within 5 minutes, I was on the phone to the nuncio saying, yes, I wasn't going to leave the house, he said, until I called him. That's, you spend years preparing for the priesthood in the seminary, and then in 5 minutes, you're a bishop. It is incredible what goes through But I haven't looked back, and it scared me to death at first. But and I thought, well, this had better be the means of my salvation, because otherwise it's going to be the means of the opposite. So better take this seriously. And I've been happy ever since. And I know you have too. Tough times sometimes, but happy. You became the founding bishop of Colorado Springs, having already lived here for a number of years before that. Tell us a little bit about how that came about. Were you part of, because this is something I don't know about either, were you part among those consulted for the establishment of the Diocese of Colorado Springs, or were you just informed of that also?
I was on the Archbishop's staff at that time, and I know that he had shared with all of us that he thought the Archdiocese of Denver was way too big, and that there was that he pointed out Colorado Springs as a good example where the people didn't feel like the bishop's presence was there enough. And he felt like what really should happen in his own mind was that there should be three new dioceses created at once.
Oh, really? Three?
He wanted to create the Northern Colorado Diocese of Fort Collins and the Western Slope Diocese of Grand Junction.
Grand Junction, sure.
And the Mid-Central or Central East Diocese of Colorado Springs. He thought...
And Pueblo already existed.
Mm-hmm. At that time, Exxon, it was during the huge oil crisis of 73 and afterwards, and Exxon had gone into the parachute rifle area and had begun to mine shale, oil shale, because that looked like it was going to be the future of our energy. And there are huge deposits over there. So Exxon, they built thousands of homes in the Grand Junction area, and they were all set to just do all kinds of mining there. And the oil crisis went away rather suddenly, and oil became available, and Exxon pulled out, and that just shot that whole concept of Grand Junction being a diocese. There wasn't going to be the growth anticipated, nor was there going to be the income, and the Bishop of Pueblo said, this isn't going to work. They can't support themselves. But it would have been nice, because it would have given a flavor to a diocese that would have served the ski areas, the tourist areas, and also that growing energy area of Colorado. So the Archbishop had good vision, I thought. However, the Holy See will not do that, we found out.
It just will not do what?
Will not create that many dioceses all at once.
Oh, I see.
And it turns out, I think that's right. At the time, it seemed like, gee whiz, why won't they be more creative? But that's a huge impact on the church in a state. The next question then was, what diocese, if Grand Junction wasn't going to be a diocese, which one should the Archbishop forward? And he thought Colorado Springs should be next. So that's how we got on the list. And then began to go through that process of being named a diocese, which is a pretty lengthy process.
Preparing for the establishment of a diocese, the installation of its first bishop is a big task. You've told to me and to many people on a number of occasions the great story of sort of the what would we call it, the mishap, the embarrassment of the day of your installation. You were already a bishop, so you're being installed as the first bishop. But I'm sure there are many who haven't heard that delightful story.
Oh, it is a delightful story. It was, first of all, we had rented out the Pikes Peak Center, which held about 2,500 if you opened up the stage and everything. So it was large. And then KRDO Television had agreed to do an exclusive coverage, full-length coverage of it. But they were limited to 2 hours because they had to meet their news schedule. And so we scheduled it so that could all be done. So everything was kind of timed down very closely. Well, we were standing in line to begin the procession into the Pikes Peak Center, and Archbishop Laghi was a great human being.
Nuncio.
Yeah, the nuncio. He was, as a matter of fact, had just been named nuncio 2 days prior. President Reagan had just recognized the Vatican. That raised the delegate to the stature of nuncio, and now he became recognized as a diplomat of first stature, which had its own story around it, because the Colorado Springs Police Department got word of that and found out they had a diplomat and they had to provide diplomatic protection for him. So all of a sudden, we had police guards all around us. The Archbishop and I had our own bodyguards. They just got scared. And so at any rate, we're standing in line, and the Archbishop had the translation of the papal apostolic letters, which are, in short, were called the papal bull.
This is the letter of actual appointment.
It was the Holy Father's words,
right,
appointing me as the bishop and establishing the diocese.
Nice.
Right. And it's called a bull. That's just a alliteration. It's just a literal translation from bulla, which means official seal. But in English, we just say bull. So he's standing there, and one of the sisters that was helping to organize the procession said, "Archbishop, it doesn't look good for you to be holding a piece of paper in the procession. I'll have it for you." He said, "I prefer to hold it myself." She said, "No, it won't get lost." So in we go. It comes time for him to read the apostolic letters. And he got up there, and they had the wrong translation in front of him. He had his own translation, and he wanted it. So he said, "I'm looking for this translation that I had when I was."
This is the one he handed off at the beginning.
This is the one he handed off.
Yeah.
Well, they couldn't find it. Oh. And Monsignor John Slattery was the MC for the ceremony, and I've never seen him so pale. For 3 minutes, we had dead air on television, which is a frightening thing. 3 minutes it took to find this thing. It seemed like an eternity. So when he got it, he read it, but he had the habit of slipping his glasses off and on when he was nervous. And the lens fell out of his glasses. So he had to read the apostolic letter. With one eye closed. And when I got up at the time for me to make remarks, I just turned to him and I said, "Archbishop Loggie, this is cattle country, but it's the first time we've ever lost a papal bull." And so everybody laughed, but he did not laugh.
The Archbishop, he didn't get it, or
no,
he didn't appreciate it?
He didn't get it.
Oh.
The Archbishop said he didn't get the connection. And, you know, when somebody turns to you in a language that's not your first language and says something that you don't understand and the auditorium comes unglued because they did laugh, you think they're laughing at you. So the Archbishop said, "I saved your bacon, friend. I explained to the nuncio what you meant." Well, and World Youth Day in Denver in 1993, this is years later, now Cardinal Loggie's walking through Celebration Square in Denver. He's got two other cardinals with him, and he sees me in the square, and he says, "Bishop Hanifin, Bishop Hanifin, tell them how we lost the bull. Tell them how we lost the bull."
So looking back on it, he had a good sense of humor about it.
We sent him the tape from the TV station.
Oh.
We sent him the tape as a memento,
yeah.
And he never forgot it. Yeah. As a matter of fact, when he installed Cardinal Stafford in Denver, he referred to it as the apostolic letters because he said, not 100 years ago or 1,000 miles away, this was once called the papal bull, but it was misunderstood for some reason. And so now we never call it that. We call it the apostolic letters.
Really?
He actually said that.
Ah, you're right, because the installations of bishops that I've been to, you don't hear that term.
They dropped it.
Yes. Wow. You know, you mentioned World Youth Day in Denver, in our backyard here. Of course, I was not in Colorado yet, and you were the bishop here in Colorado Springs. Maybe when we come back from our break, you could talk just a bit about the experience of having Pope John Paul II here in Denver, or here in the state of Colorado, in the Denver area, and what that meant to you and what you think that meant to the Catholics and the other people here in Colorado. We'll do that in just a moment.
Saturday evening, September 18th at the Pikes Peak Center in Colorado Springs, join renowned author and speaker Christopher West for Fill These Hearts, God, Sex, and the Universal Longing. It will be an evening of beauty and reflection on Pope John Paul II's theology of the body, a bold, organic, and contemporary understanding of human love in the divine plan. In a journey through art, music, live performance, and spoken presentations, come to know the meaning behind the Catholic teaching on human sexuality and how it illuminates life's deepest questions. For more information about Christopher Weston, Colorado Springs, and to register, visit www.filltheseheart.org. That's www.filltheseheart.org.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Bishop Richard Hanifin, Bishop Emeritus of the Diocese of Colorado Springs, but founding Bishop of the Diocese, and he's been sharing with us some wonderful stories from his own life and experience as a bishop. But Bishop Hanifin, I'd like to go back to, it was 1993, when Pope John Paul II came to Denver to preside over World Youth Day, and I watched it on television myself from St. Louis, but you were deeply involved in that. Speak a little bit about your experience of that and I think how it changed the people here in Colorado.
It was an awesome event, one that I could not have possibly foreseen. I don't think anybody did. I know some of the dynamic that went on in the Archdiocese getting ready for it. And it was a huge undertaking, raising of a lot of money, and Archbishop Stafford had a huge task on his hand. Literally, the Archdiocese was turned upside down trying to get ready. I'm sure that happens everywhere when the Holy Father comes. But the atmosphere in the church in those days was reactive to Pope John Paul II in many cases. And there were lots of threats in different parts of the press and so forth that indicated that there would be protests all over the place in Denver, and that Denver was going to become a focal point of the polarization in the church, that Pope John Paul was stepping back from some of the reforms of the council, tightening the screws, as it were, in Rome, and centralizing the church, and that the reaction was going to show up in Denver. I don't know this for a fact myself, but apparently it was a bit of a scary situation for him and those who were preparing for the event. The press was handling it that way, and so a lot of the advanced press was sort of threatening. When the Holy Father came here, it was totally the opposite story. He was completely welcomed. The young people, 300,000 or more, were so receptive. And no matter what the pundits have to say, the kids know what they believe and what they want. And they were just overwhelmed with the fact that he was coming. And it is a great event, as you know, from having been to those World Youth Days yourself. See Chinese, Italian, French, Spanish, Korean, Filipino kids talking to each other and walking with their signs through the streets of your city. It was amazing. Probably the most overwhelming aspect of it was his arrival at the airport. We were invited as the bishops of the region to be in the welcoming committee, and it was there that he met President Clinton and his entourage, and he brought quite a few people on Air Force One with him, including Hillary and Chelsea and Donna Shalala and all of the Catholics on his cabinet and many others. And so it was a huge undertaking. I recall very well being in the secured area of that special place where they take you when Air Force One met Alitalia One at the Papal One, and the two 747s sitting on the tarmac at the Denver airport, and President Clinton coming in, who got there first. I've always been able to say that I told the president where to go, because I saw him standing by himself for a moment, and I just went over and said, "President Clinton, how often do you just end up standing by yourself?" And he said, "Not very often. By the way, where's the bathroom?" And I told President Clinton where to go. So it was great to see the two of them. The life issues came immediately. Pope John Paul always would compliment the people of the United States for our generosity and our concern for world needs, but he would also say, "You have a weakness You have a weakness. You do not regard life. You don't respect life enough. And so the two of them were cordial, but they had their encounter immediately. They then went by helicopter to Regis University in Denver, where Regis hosted the two of them for their meeting with one another, and their private meeting, which took place there. Then from the Regis University campus, the helicopters then moved toward the stadium. The papal helicopter came to the stadium, the Broncos stadium, and the president's helicopter went back to the airport for him to go back to Washington. The kids in that stadium, Mile High Stadium, were so excited, and the bishops were all placed in their place. I recall being moved to tears, and I think there were very few dry eyes among the bishops that afternoon when that huge helicopter came into just outside the stadium, and the cameras were catching it coming in, and those kids were becoming frenzied in their excitement. And it's so contagious. When young people get excited, old people get excited. I saw that happen to the Pope. I'm sure you did too. Those kids just brought him to life. Well, they brought all of us to life. And I hope young people somehow get the message how important they are in the lives of older people, because they really do give us life. And so in he came, and it was just organized pandemonium. I've never been so thrilled by anything in my life. It's probably the most thrilling moment I've ever had was when he came into that stadium. From there, it was just one exciting thing after another. We had the downtown center, Civic Center, was devoted entirely to the bishops and the youth together all during the 3 days of the World Youth Day. And so we would be hearing confessions or meeting with the kids, walking through the square, the cardinals, bishops, priests, kids, all mingling. It was just an amazing thing. And the kids loved it. One young man said, I was going to have lunch with the Holy Father at the cathedral. We'd been invited to have lunch with him. And I said to the kids that were there, what do you want me to tell the Pope? Because when I see him, this one young guy said, I'm 23 years old. Tell the Holy Father, I left the church when I was 17. I'm coming back because he came to me. Tell him that's how important he is. So I did. I told the Pope, I said this, you know. And the Pope said his characteristic, oh. So.
That's a very concrete story. And, of course, there's many that we don't know about. But was there a sense after the World Youth Day was over that at least for a time there was actually a noticeable change, a sense of expression of holiness, of zeal? Or were you able to see that among the people at all?
Well, you know, yes. I was in the habit of going to the cathedral for the Holy Saturday greeting, a getting together of the RCIA group, people who were coming into the church on the Easter Vigil. And there was a huge group of young people that were coming into the church. And this was maybe 1995, somewhere. It was after the sex abuse scandal had raised its ugly head in the early days of that scandal. And so I said to the people that were there, do you mind if I ask you, why is it so many of young people are in this group? In view of the fact that the church doesn't look so good right now in many people's eyes. And several of them said, it was when the Pope came to Denver, I said, I want to be one of them. So I saw that, that was 2 or 3 years later. I saw that concrete impact on people. And if that was happening at our cathedral, it must have been happening elsewhere as well.
How are you enjoying your retirement?
Do you know, I love it because we all had a vision of what we wanted to be as a priest, and that immediately gets wiped out almost. You know, you know what you want to do, and immediately you're involved in what you should do and what the church needs from you. But when you retire, in a sense, you get to pick and choose what you do And that I have loved, because I've always loved being able to give spiritual direction for people. And I've always loved being able to serve in the parish through the Eucharistic liturgies. And it's much easier to hear confessions now. I actually stepped away from doing that when I was the ordinary here, because people were using those occasions sometimes to make their point. And I didn't want to become involved in that. So, and now it's just fun, because you're the poor guy that has to worry about all that now, and I don't. So I get to be a priest and do things that we love. I get to teach. And
retirement for most priests isn't what retirement is for a lot of other people. You're still very busy. I know you get a golf game in here now and then, but I know that you're available to help with masses in parishes, confessions, as you said. You're certainly a great help to me during confirmation season, and as you said, that that's sort of doing those priestly things, and you don't have to be worried or burdened with the other things. So it's a good time for you, right?
I love it.
Well, very, very good. You deserve it. You have been a bishop a long time. 1974
till I can't do the math, but it's what is that? 36 years.
A long time.
It feels like it. You've been awfully good to me, by the way. I just want to tell you that. It's not easy for the bishop successor, for the bishop predecessor, to stay in the diocese. And you've really been great about that. And so I just
well, thank
I
you.
Just really appreciate
and I mean
that.
It. I appreciate and enjoy your presence here, and hang around for a while.
Okay.
I want to turn attention to probably the great watershed moment of the 20th century, and that was the Second Vatican Council. I, like you, was raised prior to the council, and in that sense, my basic formation was in the faith was before the council, but I was ordained a priest in 1971, so several years after the conclusion of the council. You in 1959, before, well, I guess just around John the 23rd announced the council, didn't he, in January of 59, and then you were ordained in what, in the spring of 59?
That's right.
All right, so you knew it was on the horizon, but you, as a priest, went through that whole transition. What was that like for you as a priest?
I tell you the truth, I was at the cathedral at the time, and Bishop Maloney, who was the auxiliary bishop of Denver at that time, to Archbishop Vere, who was ailing in those days, Bishop Maloney went to the council on behalf of the Archdiocese of Denver, and he ate his meals with us at the cathedral. So as a young priest, I was aware of the council to that extent. But frankly, I had not a clue what this was about. I just remember the installation of John the 23rd and how he was such a smiling, pleasant pope, and that's about all I paid attention to. Young priests, especially your first year of ordination, you are so caught up in how important you are. You're so busy, and people are coming to you for one thing after another. It's just, you just stay overly busy because you still have that illusion that you're going to change the world. And I was so caught up in that. I paid absolutely no attention to the council. I knew Bishop Maloney was gone. That's all it meant to me.
Was there a sense that things weren't going to really change all that much, do you think, in your mind? It was just something going on over there and life would continue on over here as usual? Or
I didn't have a clue.
Oh.
I mean, I was really ignorant of the importance of what was going on. I just stayed too busy, being a new priest.
Well, the time came, I know, when you had to take notice. We all had to take notice. And I want you to continue to reflect on that, but we now need to take another quick break.
ColoradoCatholicHerald.com is the website of the award-winning Colorado Catholic Herald newspaper. For the latest Catholic news, both at home and around the world, log on to ColoradoCatholicHerald.com. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.
We're back and here with Bishop Richard Hanifin, who has been reflecting on his years as a priest and a bishop. And just before the break, we began to talk about the Second Vatican Council, which took place in the very early years of Bishop Hanifin's priesthood. And as he said, at first he used the word ignorant. Not many bishops call themselves ignorant, Bishop Hanifin.
This one does.
But you sort of just weren't paying attention. Is that what that was?
I just was too busy.
Yeah.
You know, I my experience of the first year of priesthood, in a sense, is mirrored a little bit in priests even who are in their first year at this time. In the church, you just get caught up in what it is to be a priest and the things that are much more taken for granted in our older lives and in our the routines of our life are not routine for a new priest. And so your attention and your heart is in that. What happens in the broader church? Well, it eventually will affect you, but it doesn't right now. So I was kind of there. But when I got sent back to Catholic University. I was all of a sudden, even though I was studying psychology, I was in the midst of priests who were studying theology and who were caught up in the controversies of the time that were beginning to surface. And we would drink beer together and argue church. And I was with people who are now famous, you know, who became well known because of those days at Catholic U. And so I got caught up in the discussions and the polarization that I could see coming, and that began to affect me that way before the council ever really ended. The council ended in 65, I believe, and we began to implement it, but before that I saw some of the disturbances and that were coming out of the changes that were being anticipated and the discussions that were going on during the council. Those were very vibrant days at Catholic U, but they were also controversial. And so I got a chance to step away from the everyday life of the parish and get caught up in that a little bit. That helped me tremendously, I think, when the actual implementation of the council took place, not to see it as some horrible thing, but rather as a challenging thing. So I was really helped. And then, of course, I was in Rome from 66 to 68, and those were the early days of the discussions and implementation of the council, too. So I got a flavor from some of the priests with whom I was living were periti experts that were at the council, and or priests that worked on some of the issues that the council. So we had some good conversations, and I didn't feel nearly so lost when the implementation began as some of the priests who didn't get those advantages that I got.
What about the people here in Colorado? I guess everywhere there were those for whom it was a very, very difficult time, for some a very exhilarating time, and maybe there were those for whom it didn't make all that much difference. But what was the scene like here? Was it difficult? Do you think the implementation was done as well as it could have been here? I don't think in my own experience it was.
Oh no. I hope we've learned. We were still in the mode of when the church speaks, you do it, and you talk about it later. And we were coming out of that way of thinking. There weren't all the questions that would be raised nowadays when something was brought forth to be implemented. And so the bishops, most of whom had been to the council, still were not ready for the implementation of the issues that they had themselves voted on. That takes time. And if they weren't ready, certainly the priests weren't. And if the priests weren't, certainly the people weren't. So the priests did not march in lockstep when the bishop would say, we're going to do this. And so the people didn't march in lockstep either. And I think the pressures were growing on Pope Paul VI from a number of different areas in church life that were, in a sense, I feel like he was backed into a corner. And he was being told that, particularly in regard to the implementation of the liturgy, that if he wasn't firm on this, that there would be revolution, some kind of anarchy, liturgical anarchy, particularly from the side of those who simply did not want the liturgy to be changed. my sense was that there was kind of a reaction to that, and that the implementation was pretty much a command performance, and one that the bishops tried to implement without understanding it completely. Liturgists were not in agreement on what should and shouldn't be, nor were the priests. And so the people got caught in the middle of that. And they experienced the reform in very uneven situations. So that one diocese began to differ from another in regard to the implementation, how it happened. It was a huge change for people. Your neighboring diocese could look almost entirely different from yours. And people were traveling back and forth from one diocese to another to get what they wanted, or from one parish to another, which was new. That was different. So that church life was changing without our reflecting on it. And the result was abuse at times, where people were terribly offended. Other times they were offended when they shouldn't have been. It's simply because they weren't informed. And you know as well as I do how hard it is to inform people nowadays of anything. So that try as we did, the folks came along very slowly. And for some, we just didn't do it fast enough. And for others, we just did it wrong. For the majority, it was kind of new life. And liturgy did take on new meaning for them. And they began to embrace it and began to really see it as a part of their life and not just the priests, not just a devotion for them, but a real participation.
Pope Benedict XVI has on a number of occasions highlighted what he thinks is one of the great, I guess, misunderstandings of people, and that is that the Second Vatican Council was a moment of rupture, a time when, in a sense, we set aside the church of the last 1900 years and, for all practical purposes, created a new one. And I mean, he would claim that that's the cause of many problems. We casually use phrases like, well, it's pre-Vatican II, as if that's from something that's either bad or perhaps even dead and gone now. And he's tried to emphasize that throughout the history of the church, there of course have always been developments and change, and at sometimes those changes were rather significant, but it's the one church of Christ that has continued to grow and develop. We ought not to think that we are in a time now of some sort of brand new church, but rather and we see that, I think, in his attempt to maybe even recapture at least some of the expressions of the church prior to the council, which I guess some people still don't like, you know, but by no means is he or had John Paul II retreated from the Second Vatican Council, but want to try to give us the very best possible understanding of that council and do away with the misunderstandings that we have. But I think we're making progress, don't you?
You know, I was always impressed when Pope John announced the council, and he talked about aggiornamento and opening the windows of the church so that the world could find its way into us and we could find our way out to the world, that there was a huge dialogue begun that was sort of modern. And it was begun in a time in which there was mass communication as there has never been before in history. So that whatever dialogue was going on between the church and the modern world, that dialogue was public, never private. It was instantaneously communicated and created unique situations the church has never before had to deal with. The church has suffered terribly from trying to come into the age of communication where you get instant impressions, whether they're true or not. And our people have suffered from that. What you're talking about, I think, is one of those cases where the impression was that we were going to turn the altars around and fix everything. And I remember saying to someone recently, it doesn't make any difference which way the altar faces, which way the priest faces, if we don't turn our hearts around. The Vatican Council is not going to have its effect. That's what Pope John asked for, was the conversion of hearts. That's the only reason you try to reform the church or to form anew the church or renew the church, is to turn the hearts of people around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very good. We have just a few minutes left. Let me hit you with this question as our sort of our exit. What do you see as maybe the one or more than one significant challenges on the horizon? What are we looking at as the church, either here in Colorado or maybe throughout the Western world? What's our big challenge? We always have challenges. We always have difficulties, things that we're trying to deal with. What do you see as maybe number one out there?
It's not new. The challenge the church has always faced is, in every case, she's part of a culture. She receives from a culture. The culture is like the water in which a fish swims. In a sense, the church swims in the water of a culture, no matter where you live. And our people are affected by the culture in which they swim, as it were. And the gospel calls for them to have an effect on the culture in which they swim. The tension between those two roles, those two realities in our lives, is not going to go away. So the issues of women's role in the church and society, the question of human sexuality, the meaning of homosexuality that I still think society does not understand, and we need to continue to learn about, the issues of life, its beginning and its dignity, those are going to continue to challenge us, our culture, day in and day out. And how does the church communicate the good news in this instant communication culture? And how does she keep from being miscommunicated and misunderstood by the way her message is handled? I think those are huge challenges that we'll have to face.
And I think we live in a time too when the sort of the distance between that secular culture and what we might call a Catholic or a truly humanistic culture, is that distance is pretty far sometimes. And it's it seemed like it was easier even when I was very young, you know, for the gospel to be at home in the secular culture. Not so much anymore. I think, you know, among the things you mentioned, of course, all true. I see the challenges to marriage and family life as being so significant. These other ones, you're right, they don't go away. We're still battling for the ultimate respect for human life. But if we see the family, if we see marriage and the family begin to significantly disintegrate, we're not just in trouble as a church, but as a people, as a culture, as a society. So I think we really need to do our work there. Bishop, thank you. Thank you for being here. We just have a few seconds left, and I'd like to offer a final prayer and blessing for all of our listeners. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, we ask you to continue through your Son and your Holy Spirit to bless and enrich the church of your Son, Jesus Christ, the church which we love, the church which we embrace, and the church which is sometimes can be difficult for any of us to live in. We truly believe that this is the body of Christ. It is the means of our salvation, and please give us the strength to stand strong against whatever challenges there are to the dignity of life of the human person. And may Almighty God bless all of you out there, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000.